Hey, this is Brian Fallon, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is your old pal Chris Shiplett, and you are listening to episode number 178 of America's favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. What a week, huh? What a week. So much has changed since my last episode. The election's over, technically. I mean, I guess it's still going to drag on for a while, but Biden has officially been declared the winner. I was out in New York City on Saturday, over the weekend when they officially called it for him. And it was crazy. I got to tell you, you could right away, even before I noticed that it had been officially called, you could just hear cars honking their horns and people cheering in the streets. And it was nice to see some optimism in this world. You know, people have been so down for so long that it just made me kind of happy to see everybody celebrating. And the mood was very joyful. You know, I think it's a good time to reflect on the sad fact that the thing that's replacing Trump, like, just because Trump is so bad, and he is so bad, he is all those things that they say he is. He's terrible. He's a racist. He's just awful. I hate everything that guy stands for. I hate everything his movement stands for. But I have no illusions about what Joe Biden stands for and what a Biden-Harris administration are actually going to work for. And I think it's a good time to just kind of remember that, because I heard a lot of people saying things like, oh, he's gone, or it's over, you know, blah, blah, all that kind of stuff. And I hate to be the one to break it to you. I hate to be that big cold bucket of ice water, but it's not over. He's not gone. Trumpism isn't going anywhere, regardless of the outcome of this election. And, you know, unfortunately, the Democratic Party these last few years basically just refused to have, like, an internal reckoning about why Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. And Biden ran pretty much on not being Trump and a return to the sort of 2016 status quo. But when you consider that the 2016 status quo is what created Trump in the first place, or at least what made him a viable candidate, like, in my mind, there's considerably less to be optimistic about, especially when you look at some of the names that have been floated as potential cabinet picks for Biden. I mean, it's pretty disheartening from a progressive point of view, and I'm a progressive. But when you look at people like John Kasich and Eric Schmidt and all their ilk, it's, I don't know. I think it's going to be a rough 4 years. And maybe some of you folks out there might be a little surprised when the Republican Party comes roaring back in 2024, if they do. But, you know, the reality is that the establishment wing of the Democratic Party just vanquished their insurgent progressive left wing again and barely squeaked by Trump in the general. So right now, that the establishment wing of the Democratic Party is emboldened. And if you don't believe me, just look at the sort of center right crowing that's going on Twitter right now. It's to me, it's nuts. But progressives are going to get nothing out of these folks without holding their feet to the fire. So don't sleep on them, people. Don't sleep on them. The last thing that this country needs are 4 years of neoliberals not addressing the socioeconomic mess that fueled Trumpism in the first place, resulting in the obvious ascendance of somebody like Josh Hawley or Tom Cotton or whoever picks up the mantle where Trump left off. And we do not want those folks roaring back in 2024, because the next Trump probably won't be as incompetent as this one's been. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my rant for the week. So let's get to something light, like selling music gear with our good friends over at Zounds.com. Did you know that Zounds.com has been around since way back in 1996? If you didn't know that, it all started as a small little retail shop and has since grown to become one of the biggest and most badass online musical instrument retailers on earth. So get on over to Zounds.com. Let's get to the interview, people.
In this life there will be trouble, but you shall overcome.
All right, I have a great interview for you this week with my buddy Brian Fallon, former guitar player, singer, songwriter from the Gaslight Anthem, and a man who has put out a whole slew of solo records since Gaslight disbanded, the latest of which is called Local Honey. So get on over to your favorite streaming service and listen to that now. And his album actually came out right when COVID kind of happened. And Brian, like everybody else, had to scrap all his plans and start playing live streams and adapt to the troubled times. But he was hosting for a little while a really great interview live stream thing that I know he put on hold and was saying he might turn it into like a podcast or something. So hopefully he does that. Get on over to his social media and see where he's at and see what he's keeping himself busy with. We cover all kinds of stuff in this interview, but we kick it off talking about mustaches and tank tops and being pale in the summertime. This is Brian Fallon on Walking the Floor. Hey, buddy.
How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah.
This is typical California versus New Jersey. Look at you. You're beautiful and tan. You got a hat on. Your hair is exquisite. And I have glasses and a shaved head. Pale as could be in the summer.
I will tell you, my wife would be horrified if she knew that I was doing this in this condition. Two things, mustache and tank top, she has real strict aversions to. Does not.
Why?
I can't figure it out. That's why I keep asking myself.
Yeah, it's great.
I've had a beard for so long. I shaved it off and I left my mustache the other day. And my wife and children are so horrified. And I think they're starting to get used to it. But like every time I wake my kids up in the morning, they're like, ah.
Yeah, you got to get a different family.
Totally. Yeah. That's what they keep saying.
Yeah, that's all right.
So, you know, I love your sitting around with series that you've been doing, but I noticed the other day that you posted something saying you were putting that on hold to do some writing or just focus on other stuff. And but you alluded to perhaps coming back with a podcast at some point. What do you got planned?
Well, maybe. It depends on like that was sort of just like pillow talk, you know, ease the blow. No, I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe I will. If somebody said like, I'll give you some kind of reason to do that, then I would do it. But I feel like I got what I wanted out of the session, which was, you know, just to talk to people and feel like it wasn't such a weird time during this quarantine. But
yeah,
I don't know. I don't know more than that. Like I'm not a commitment of like task person.
Yeah. It's the strange thing. That's something I've found over the years doing this. Cause I've tried various ways of sort of putting it out in the world. And at one point I did a deal with a podcast distributor, and it was just a really, like, it just didn't work for me. Cause I was like, fuck, I didn't get into this to have a boss. It was like having a boss, you know, is what it kind of felt like, or you know what it felt like? It felt like I'd signed a shitty record deal. Is what it felt like.
Ooh,
you know, yeah,
I do.
Like,
yes,
it had that feeling too. I was like, I like that. I can post it every 2 weeks or every 1 week or every 3 weeks or just take fucking 6 months off and who cares?
That's awesome. That's the way to do it. You know, you wake up in your underwear, have a mustache. Sometimes you don't want to
exactly,
go to work.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I would say that I thought you were a good host, asked good questions, all that kind of stuff. So. The world wants that podcast, man. Come back with it at some point.
Well, maybe I will. You know, I mean, I can be swayed by nearly anything by money. So,
yeah, you're talking to the wrong guy.
I'm just completely kidding.
Yeah, well, I think that's why so many podcasts go away so quick is when people realize, oh shit, there really isn't any money in this unless you're Joe Rogan. you know? Yeah.
No, I don't think that, like, I don't know that would even make it easier. I think that if I was getting paid or sponsored, I would still be like, I don't want to talk to every, because after a while I was just like, man, I just want to like not do this today. There'd be days where I'd just have a tough time getting into it. And then once it was on, it was fine.
Yeah.
But like, I like having nothing better.
Yeah. Yeah, it's me too. I love it. I had a really productive first few months of this whole coronavirus time that we're in, but there was a certain point that I just kind of had to go, fuck, I just want to go to the beach. Fuck this. I'm working too hard.
Gotta have that chill time a little bit.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, obviously you're several records into, you know, making solo records at this point with one that just came out earlier this year. But I don't remember, was there like an official Gaslight Anthem breakup like thing, or did you guys just go, or did you go on a hiatus? Like what, how did that work exactly? Cause I don't remember ever like we're breaking up or whatever, but you just kind of seemed to have segued into making solo records at some point.
Yeah, there was like a little announcement that we made, but I think like at some point we all collectively went, like I remember the actual day when we sat down and we just kind of like, we looked at each other and I was like talking to Benny, the drummer, and we sort of like would always talk like that. And I was like, this sucks. I was like, what, this sucks. It's not fun. Like, I don't want to go on stage ever again.
Why was it not, how had it gotten to be not fun?
Well, a lot of the thing came from sort of like expectations. Like you'd get those, I don't know if you've ever like gotten that thing, like you know, you're in like massive stuff, but like when we would go to like a place and then they'd be like, wow, you did like, you know, this specific place. It was like, you did 7,000 tickets in Germany, like this place last time. This time you did 6,200. The promoter really says you're going down.
Right.
And I was like, but it was like that every minute. Everything was a disappointment. We were like the worst stepchild. Like, and I don't know. Like, and our band sort of like, we got to this point where we were big. We were way bigger than we ever thought we were going to be as a punk band. But at the same time, it was just like, we had already satisfied all the goals that we wanted to do. We were like, we want to make great records and we want to like tour and have fun and like hang out with our friends and like, you know, like maybe have a few beers and rock, you know, just like play all these random places from like squat houses to like big places. If we could, we thought that was insane that we got to do it. And then after a while it just became, well, what now? Like, cause this is stupid. And like, we definitely were far away from that place where, I guess like bands, like earlier, they would like some of my older friends that are a few years older than us, they would say like, yeah, I don't know. Like we got paid like to sign a record deal and like, I just invested in like I bought a bar or I bought 10 bars. And I was like, dude, I didn't make enough to pay my car insurance. You know? And I was just like, this is lame. Like still, I mean,
that's such a big life decision when you've like, for anybody that's actually clawed their way into that position, you know, you guys know firsthand how difficult that is and what sort of rarefied air that is to be making a living, making music and have some success with it. Like, I imagine that must have been a really big, hard decision.
You know, it's so funny because for us, it wasn't. And like, things like that for us just weren't. It was always like, hey, like, do you feel like we did, do you want to do anything else? Does anybody here have, like, I remember the thing, like on the day that we decided, we're like, does anyone else have any good ideas like to do anything else?
Right.
And everyone was like, nah, this sucks. Like cause we were just away from our family all the time. And like, we were sort of doing things that we were really proud about, but it got to the point where like, I guess, the only way I can describe it, it was like, you know, you'd go and you'd have these really great ideas. And it was almost like you painted like the thing that you felt was like your masterpiece. And after that, the desire to paint that masterpiece was fulfilled. And you sort of said, I've got to find a new masterpiece. And this isn't it. And rather than go fake it until I'm 50 and everybody else, you know, and we all sort of said like, yeah, that's a good reason to stop. Let's just bail. And that was it.
That's so much less messy than most band breakups tend to be. That's kind of amazing. I mean, did you guys grow up together? Were you like childhood friends or like teenage friends or whatever?
No, we met when we were in our like early to mid 20s.
So what were, give me like the condensed, you know, sort of this is your life, like where you grew up, what your family life was like, what got you into music, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. My mom was a folk singer when she was young. So she, you know, there was always music around the house. And then she, you know, she would sing folk songs and hymns all the time, play guitar. And I just got an ear for it and started to like it. And then I took lessons when I was like 12, basically was like, you know, I'm going to play like along with the Clash, and I want to play guitar and write my songs. So I had a desire to do that. And then I learned the guitar strictly for the purpose of writing songs. I didn't care anything about playing the guitar.
Really? So you were a songwriter from the get-go.
Yeah, big time. I just could not care less about anything else with, like, you know, playing it or efficiently or anything. That came much later. And then I only wanted to learn chords so I could just, like, get on with the songwriting. And then that's it. Like, went through a bunch of bands. Like, they were terrible, and like some bands were pretty good, but never got anywhere until I was like in my like mid to late 20s, and then these guys basically had been doing the same things, and then we all were coming from the New Brunswick scene where like Thursday had already like catapulted out of, and like My Chem was a giant band, but we didn't know any like, I guess we knew some of Thursday, but nobody in My Chem or anything like that. And we just started playing like the like bars and the clubs and the DIY venues and your living room. And that was what we thought was like, we were like, yeah, cool. We'll be like Fugazi, but we'll sound different. This is great.
Wow. So, I mean, that was all sort of pre Side One Dummy, right? Did you guys have a record out before you put out your first record on Side One? Didn't you have like a record prior to that?
Yeah, we had a record and an EP that we had put out on like pretty much just our friend's label, and then like another friend's label.
And so what, were you guys already touring stuff? Like, how did you wind up hooking up with a label based out of LA, being from the East Coast?
Well, we were on tour all the time. So like before we even put those records out, we had like demos, and we were old school. Like, we were like really DIY about it. And we just got in the van and started calling places. Like, we'd play like ice cream shops and like bookstores, like especially like anarchist bookstores and things like that, like super, you know, like places that would have bands in a bookshop, you know, and like we would do all that stuff, and we were into it. We're so into it. Just like there's a scene in like Kansas. Cool. Let's go do it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We were just way into it. Like it didn't matter. We sort of came from that post genre era where it was like, oh, you play like jazz music with spoken words, but you like Minor Threat. Cool. Yeah. We're friends. Let's play shows together. We didn't care at all. It was all this mixed blend of basically like bands that didn't have a scene. Cause we weren't part of anything. Like, we weren't like metal, like we're metal, you know,
right,
like we're
right.
Hardcore. So we just had this like thing, and we kind of did that like from the late 90s stuff, but like all the Florida stuff, Hot Water Music and Virginia Vale, where they sort of like broke genre codes.
Right. It's interesting because, yeah, I mean, I remember when you guys first started working with Side One, because, you know, me and Bill and Joe are good friends and everything, and they gave me a copy of your record. And to me, it struck me as like, like very tuneful, you know, real like songs, you know, instead of, it was like, it was punk rock, but it was like song based, you know?
Yeah.
Like a different, like it was just, it was a breath of fresh air, but what am I trying to say? Different than other shifts in punk rock, where like there was a wave of bands. Like, I think maybe a little before you guys would have been like Get Up Kids and all those bands that seemed like a wave of bands, a changing of the guard. It was no longer Fat Records, Epitaph, 90s punk. It was getting into that whatever, you know, sort of emo thing that happened after that. You know what I mean? Like, whereas with you guys, it seemed like a left turn, but it was like a movement of one or something. You know what I mean? I don't think of any other, like, were there other Gaslight Anthem-esque bands that came up around the same time? Like, I don't know.
Well, we Against Me was probably the first one. They had that kind of like song thing.
Were you guys considered part of the same, you know, subgenre of punk rock? I don't know.
Probably. Okay. I mean, they were much more like anarchist, like vibe punks. Like, they were different kind of, they were like punks, you know, like we're punks.
Right.
And we were more like, yeah, whatever. You know, we were just more like, we're
playing at the anarchist bookstore, but whatever.
Yeah, but not whatever to them. We were just whatever to everybody. We're from the East Coast. Like, really, we were really from the East Coast, and we cared about nothing but being good. And we had our little scene, but we had been rejected by so many scenes that we just sort of said, like, yeah, whatever. And, oh, you guys, like, you guys are emo and you guys are hardcore, whatever. We're the song people, whatever. We're going to try it. You know, I'm trying to pay rent. You know, I don't care about what this
is. How is that later shift for you guys? Like going, you put out a couple records on side one and then signed to a major label. Like, so how was that shift from like putting out your first record on your buddy's label, very small, to side one, which was like a big indie and certainly a step forward, and then to something like a big major label? Like, what was, I guess, like, how did you guys handle that? What were the differences in terms of expectations or relationships with the people you're working with and all that sort of thing?
Well, for us, it was so similar between all these steps because we had done so much groundwork in between them. Like, we basically did everything on our own. So, like, Joe would call us up from side one and be like, hey, so like, we should talk about the radio single. And I was like, yeah, it's 59 Sound. Cool, bye. And he'd be like, what are you talking about? You don't know anything about it. And I'm like, no, trust me, man, it is. And then like, we'd just go play it. And I'd be like, Joe, we just played 500 shows where the one song that all the kids lost their minds to was this song. Trust me, it's this song. And like, somehow that worked, which is insane because I didn't know anything. I had nothing but gut instinct. But like, we had developed our gut instincts, and our trust went so far with people that we worked with to where Joe and Bill were like friends, and like, they knew that we had not just said this stuff out of, we were so careful and thoughtful. And then even when we went to the major, we got lucky. Like, the guy that signed us became the president of the label, like, overnight, just like, bam. Mm. So we pretty much had like I had the cell phone of Island Records president. And I was just like, hey, man.
That's the complete opposite of the classic major label story of the guy that signed us left the company before our record came out, and we didn't have a champion there.
Right. So that happened. But we listened to every band that gave us advice, every single one, and we filtered it in. So we knew when we signed with the major label, we had heard every horror story. And I said to the guys, and I said to Ben for sure, I was like, yo, we're going to be friends with the secretary all the way up to the top guy. We're going to be friends with everybody. And we went into the label, and we were cool to them. So we got like, they would let us know if there was a hiccup, and they would tell us like,
we were
dialed in. We weren't stupid about it because everything had been handled by us since the beginning.
Yeah. And you got to have all those people on your side.
Yeah. And if, you know, if you're nice to people, they definitely remember you.
I mean, was it still a thing by then? Like, what are we talking here? Early 2000s at this point?
No, we major label, we signed that deal probably in late 2011.
Oh, okay. All right. The 90s to now are like a blur to me in time-wise. So I get confused on the timeline. But okay, so 2011. So by that time, was there still, it used to be such a thing in the punk rock world, like, how dare you sign to a major label, you sellout corporate rock bastard. Like, was there any residue of that left by the time you guys, that wasn't a thing anymore?
Yeah, well, it wasn't a thing. It was a thing. It was a thing with, like, against me, who are friends of ours. They had such a bad time. Like,
oh, really?
people cutting up their tires.
Well, I mean, I think, like, the greatest example of that ever might be Jawbreaker, you know, when they signed to it.
Oh, yeah.
Which
was,
you know, obviously many years before, you know, your time.
Yeah. But, well, we were so careful about saying to everybody, even when we were in playing and talking to DIY zines, like some kid in his basement writing a zine that was like, we would say like, hey, we're not trying to say we're a punk band, or we might sign to a major label someday. Cause we were straight up about everything. We were just like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe like, if somebody's going to pay me, like, I've been poor for a long time, man. You know, I was like, if I could be a musician, cause I came from like construction and I was swinging hammers, carrying 50 pound bags of shingles on each shoulder. I was like, nah, this sucks. I was like, I don't play guitar.
Yeah. Somebody wants to pay me for it? Great.
Yeah. I was like, no way.
What was it like? What was the effect of, like, I remember at some point in all that, and I don't remember exactly when it was, but I remember you got up on stage with Springsteen at like Hyde Park or something.
Yeah.
And maybe you guys opened that show or whatever.
I think. Yeah. It started the day before at Glastonbury.
Oh, okay. So what was the effect of that on the band? Like, was that, did that like raise your profile in the UK significantly? Was it like, yeah. I always wonder with things like that, if there is an impact, you know, commercially.
Well, all right. So I can say it from two angles. Like I went up on stage one time and sang with Eddie Vedder came up and sang with us. And like Pearl Jam fans were like, yo, cool. You know, maybe we sold a few more t-shirts, but I'll tell you, and that was cool. And it was fine. We got a lot of respect from there. Like they have a little like cool community that follows them.
They have like a hardcore fan base. Yeah.
Yeah, and now I definitely saw those people come over because Eddie sort of gave us his blessing. But I'll tell you, when Bruce gave us his blessing, Joseph was like, yo, your CD sold like this many, and now you've sold this many.
Really?
It was like overnight. Yeah, man, because you got to remember that like when he came and played with us during the day at Glastonbury first, and there was like maybe 900 kids watching us in a tent. And then... But when I went on stage with him later that night, they told me 180,000 people nationally broadcast all over Europe and all over the UK on the biggest festival that could possibly be. It was basically like you got to pose with Jesus on Christmas morning, the first one. Like, yo, what up? I'm in the manger. And it was like, bam, like it just exploded, and people, I don't know, they dug us. But then we took so many hits from the press about it for years.
You took hits from the press? God, I would think that would be like a publicist's sweat dream.
No, it was until like the press just cut our, they just chopped us up into little pieces
from
basically they chopped me into pieces. Yeah.
Over what?
You guys are just a copycat Springsteen band, blah, 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 blah. Like all this stuff. And like it was this incessant slamming that anything we did, it was like, if I got a pen out and I was like, yo, I'm gonna do this. They're like, that's their darkness on the edge of town. That's their right. The river. That's everything was the Bruce thing. And it was just kind of like, it got so lame because it was like, the press made it lame. Like, not Bruce didn't get lame. Like, we still thought Bruce was cool. But like, they just made it like a thing that they, like an albatross for us. And it sort of became like a point of like, even like aggressiveness from them at times where they'd be like, I don't think you've written a song as good as, you know, Filter in Bruce song. Like, and I'd be like, yeah, me neither. Yeah. I'd be like, but hey, you know what? I'm doing pretty. I should, if I was smarter, if I was me now, I would have said, you know what? I don't think so either, but I'm doing pretty good because I used to work construction. What up? And I got Bruce's cell phone number. Like,
I mean, the
British smart
British press is hardcore, man. That's a whirlwind. Fucking nuts. Yeah, they love you,
but
until
they
hate you.
Support. Yeah. Sure, but they also, they always, I find that they like, they love you and then sometimes they hate you and then they always come back around. Like, they love the underdog. That's their vibe. They love the underdog.
Right.
You know, and but there wasn't everybody, but it was a lot of people. So yeah. It really became like a thing.
I mean, so interesting. So when you started making solo records, like what, and particularly your latest one, which I think is maybe the biggest sort of stylistic departure. What is it about making solo records that like, what does that allow you to do that maybe you wouldn't have been comfortable doing or wouldn't have wanted to do in the band?
Well, it's definitely quieter and it's on a smaller scale. So like the biggest thing for me is I can kind of make whatever moves I want from record to record. And I don't have to stay in with the idea of like, you know, bands have an identity and like whether there's the identity of themselves, but then there's the perceived identity. Like you can't really go beyond, there's a box that you can't leave as a band before you're no longer that band. Whereas as an individual, there's much more of a, you know, period. And like for my band in particularly, I was always sort of headed where my last record, the quiet, like acoustic songwriter thing, I've been heading there for a long time. And it sort of took me this long to get the courage to sort of make that record, because I do come from punk and other things. And, you know, it's a scary thing. Like, I know you've made records like, you know, like Americana records, and it, you know, Greg has, Frank Turner does, whatever. Sure. But like, for me, it was a little bit more of a stretch. I was afraid to personally. And then, once I did, I was able to do it in the way that I wanted to, without having to make sort of like compromises for four different people, especially when I would say, like, you know, none of those guys would get in that room and make that last record and go like, yeah, this totally sits with the, you know, our catalog. It's fine. No big deal. Right. They'd be like, you don't know what you're talking about. Where's the fast song? And I would go, I don't know. There's no fast song.
Yeah. I don't have one this time.
I don't have one. Yeah. Cause I don't want to jump up and down. My knees hurt.
There's, I mean, on that end, there was a couple quotes in your bio that I just wanted to have you elaborate on that kind of tie into that. One of them is, Brian Fallon's rock star days are firmly behind him. I'm not really trying to do anything. Right. I mean, that was just in your bio. Somebody else. I'm not really trying to do anything. I'm trying to step away from that. And there does seem like there's kind of a theme, especially in the new one, of like sort of growing up or maturing or whatever. But like, what is it? I know for me, it seems like it's a constant kind of struggle of feeling like, you know, yay, this is the greatest, or like kind of back with like, God, I just don't give a fuck anymore. Kind of those kind of feelings start to creep in there. What is it about this business, do you think, that like creates that internal tension in people? Like, even for people with success in the music business, it's still a grind in that way. And I realize, like, we're like so lucky. Like, you always have to put that disclaimer. Like, obviously we're lucky to get to do what we do, and I'm certainly not complaining about it or discounting it. But for people that don't do it, don't understand like that internal grind that it creates.
Yeah. Well, the grind isn't from the fans. The grind doesn't, that's the best part. That's the part where you do it.
Right.
So the grind comes from being like unnaturally away from your family for so long. It comes from like this like gross pressure that people put on you, where they're basically like, you had a good idea and it made us a lot of money, and now you better think of another one quickly. And it's like, or else you're done. There's constant threat of being done. And like, yeah, maybe if I was shark fishing, that would be cool odds, because hey, maybe tomorrow I'm getting eaten by a shark. But that shouldn't be your daily grind. And that's what it is. Like, I mean, in your situation, I think that I use Bruce as an example. I think Dave's a good example, like of someone who can, Billy Joe's a great example of people who can, like, they can absorb that kind of pressure and still be like, and push back. Yeah. And they channel it into like a positive unifying energy. Whereas like, for me, I'm kind of like, I'm not like, I'm trying to share something with people and then they're sharing with me. And like, I'm not ready to go to the mat with like somebody like, you know, going into every little thing about, you know, how do you even say it? I don't even know. Like it becomes a drag.
How do you guard yourself against that or find that balance in what you're doing now with the solo stuff? Cause you still have like a very engaged fan base. You know, I could tell that just from doing that episode of your show.
Well, the fan base that I have has generally grown with me. So they've been around for a long time, and they've sort of seen the ups and the downs, and they've been with the band for so many years. And now like they're often in the same place I am. Like, I feel like I'm almost like I'm on my way to getting that like sort of Tom Waitsy cult fan base, where it's like, we're into this thing and it's our secret. And like, that's cool if it's not on the radio. And that's sort of where I always envisioned in my head, like wanting to be, you know, not having the desire to play. Like, I don't know, to be honest with you. I mean, I've had offers, like, and the band has had offers to play like giant shows, and they've just been like, nah, because it's not like, that's not what it's about, I think, at the end of the day for us. And there's always in the back of my head, there's that thing, that like dark cloud that hangs, and you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like, it's just sort of the pressure and and it just becomes all about like dollars and putting, you know, people like, what do they say, like behinds in seats or whatever they're always like talking about. Like, you know, when you work with these giant companies, like, hey, we're gonna, you know, $50 on top of the ticket, just a fee.
I mean, it's an interesting thing, because I hear everything that you're saying and I get it and I relate to it. But there is this reality of, like, if you're going to put out records, no matter sort of how you approach it and how you want it to be, the business is the business, and putting your record out to a label is, you know, there are always going to be expectations, and your booking agent's going to have expectations, and your manager's going to have, you know what I mean? Like, I'm curious, like, you put your record out, your latest one, in March, just as like the world was basically collapsing all around us. Were you like, yeah, I don't have to go on tour. Fuck you guys, no. I'm not going.
I mean, like, what, 25% of me probably was. I was like, yeah, I don't have to leave my house. This is rad. But then, like, you know, the other part of me was like, man, I want to play shows. Like, shows are cool. Still like shows. And I think that there's an element of that, like, with the business of it, where this is all manageable. That's my big thing, is if it's manageable, great. If it's not manageable, then I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Because it's too hard. It gets weird.
Yeah.
I'm a weird, you know, I get weird in my head. I'm a nervous guy.
I mean, how do you sort of keep a light shining on your record, considering it came out in March, you know? I mean, it seems like from just seeing other people's releases and stuff comes out, and it's, you would think everybody's streaming numbers would be up right now, but I suspect, like, a lot of stuff is just kind of falling through the cracks because people are preoccupied with COVID or you know, civil unrest or the election year, whatever, you know, whatever the latest stupid thing Trump said or whatever, you know?
You know, that's been like the toughest part, I think, because touring is usually the way you do that. But that show probably helped. I don't know if it helped. But I was shocked. Like, I just had like the meeting talk about like, how's it doing? And it was doing okay. It was doing like pretty good. And it was like, I was like, really? Oh, all right. Like, that's way better than I thought.
Yeah.
I'm like, great. But my expectations, man, super low. You know, I just keep them low. Right. Just keep them super low.
Well, I mean, like,
yeah, you're good.
It's a great record. Let's talk about making the record a little bit. Who is who's Peter Kattis, or how do you pronounce his last name?
Kattis.
Peter Kattis. What's he like as a producer? Where's he come from?
Well, he's like produced like really. There's this indie band coming up. They're you know, they're like called the National. I don't know, Sellout Stadium, some huge band.
Like,
so he came around with them. Like, he sort of produced all their records up. I think since the beginning.
Okay.
He's done like the War on Drugs and like Kurt Vile and like the Swell Season, like,
oh, wow.
So pretty much like orchestral, like grand, but chill, mostly chill records. He did the Frightened Rabbit record though. Not chill.
There was a line I read, I think, that you said that was Peter's bar. If it made you feel sad, then it was good.
Yeah. Which
I like that bar.
Yeah, because he's just like, you know, I would be like, hey, how about this little like slide thing on the, because now I was not a guitar nerd, and now I am a guitar nerd, and right. I like, you know, I'm like, I can play, and I'm trying to learn more. I still take lessons every week.
Nice.
So I'd be like, yo, check this thing out. I got this resonator with this slide, and like, listen, I could do this country bend. And he'd be like, the sad is leaving. What are you doing?
Yeah.
And I'd be like,
you're happying it up.
Yeah. So I'd get a few. I got a few good ones on the record. I got a whole solo on that thing.
Oh, nice.
But yeah. But he was not into like your, but yo, check out this Peter Green lick. He'd be like, nah.
Well, the slide, I mean, slide is very sad in the right context, you know?
Yeah, it is for sure. So
was this your first time working with him?
Yeah, it was. It was the first time I'd worked. We had talked like in the years prior, like about working together before, and it was finally just like the right time.
I mean, how do you think, like, how do you, and it's always hard to sort of judge these things about yourself, but how do you feel like your songwriting has evolved over the years from being a young punk kid to what you're doing now? Like, even in terms of like process, has it changed much, or do you still kind of do the same thing you did 20 years ago?
No, I mean, I think that like I've tried to like improve it by just trying different things and like sort of honing in on the parts that are kind of like wishy-washy, a little bit loose, especially lyrically. And, you know, and I do study, like, and now I've taken like piano lessons and I still take guitar lessons, and just to sort of like get to the place I want to be at, which is, I'm not even clear where that is yet, but I definitely want to create something that's like great someday, or I don't know if I have, time will tell, but you know, something that people go like, that's pretty good.
Yeah. You haven't even written your, I'm trying to think of a Springsteen song and now I'm drawing a blank. You haven't even written your Thunder Road, man.
I know. But so somebody said something hilarious. I released this record, right? And it's like more acoustic based. So naturally, like, there was this critic who's like, well, this is his Nebraska.
And I was of like, of course, motherfucker.
I'm like, dude, it's not my Nebraska. It's my local honey. It's not, because what are you going to say when I release another acoustic record? Is that going to be like my Nebraska too?
That'll be your Tom Joad.
Oh, right. Yeah. Tom Joad. Right.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, you know, I tell you, I can't wait for my, my Born in the USA. How about that? Cause I can use some cash.
Seriously. You know?
Yeah.
I'm ready.
I want my, get up in the evening.
I'll be the little Stevie to your Springsteen on that.
Dude, that's sick, man. I'd be in a band with you anytime. It'd be great.
Well, so what's next for you? What do you got cooking? You had mentioned on your post that you were going to be doing some writing. Are you planning another record, or what do you got cooking?
I'm going to try. Like, I always try to work on music at pretty much as I can. So, but not obsessively. Right. So yeah, I'm going to try and develop. I'm always trying to think of like the next thing. I mean, it usually takes me a while to like get it together and figure it out. So I'm going to do that. I mean, that's pretty much it.
Cool.
Really, just try and do that.
I love it. Well, that was great, buddy. Thank you.
Yeah. Unless you like, you know, break your hand, then I'm going to get a good job. I'll get a job in your band.
You might have to push my brother Scott out of the way.
I'm just kidding.
He might have dibs.
That's not my dibs band. My dibs band is, I'm waiting for Johnny Two Bags to retire because I'm totally trying to be in Social D. So.
Aren't we all waiting for that? Fuck, man. Come on, Johnny.
I say we go
break his fucking legs, break his hands, and then we can steal his vintage guitar collection while we're at it.
Lovers, you'll stand up.
All right, that was Brian Fallon on Walking the Floor. That's it for this week. We'll see you in 2 weeks, everybody. All right, adios, amigos.
Good world, my lovely.